Hello, friends. Inflate your inner tubes and dig out your kazoos. You're listening to Blame It on Buffett.
Well, I sailed from Lauderdale down to Key Largo. Crossed the Gulf on a fast sloop, and I sailed the Abacos. As a kid, I read Contiki, and now all the pirate books, too. There's just so many places on my list to see. I'm going crazy just trying to choose.
Today on Blame It on Buffett, we have Bob Carwin, who is one of my faves. I know I say that about everybody. They're all my faves. But Bob Carwin is a very entertaining and fun person. So I'm really excited to have him on the podcast to talk about his new album, The Miles Between. I wanted to make sure I threw that title of the album in there right now at the beginning so you can rush off and look it up if you want, because at the end of the podcast when he was explaining how to download it and everything, I realized that I had not even mentioned the actual name of the album the whole time we were talking. So The Miles Between is the name of his new album. You can go and check that out if you listen to the interview. He'll explain at the end how to get it right now. It is out to get on his website and then coming soon other places. And also, I'm going to be playing for you at the end of the podcast. So after the interview, after my little outro spiel about where to find me, instead of our regular playing us off music of Blame It on Buffett, I'm going to be playing for you Alan the Taxi Man, which is a single from his new album. So I hope you stick around for that. This is a great interview. You might learn something new about Bob Carwin you didn't know. But if you are just in a rush and you want to listen to that song right away, you can always skip to the end. It's going to be the very last thing on the episode. So without further ado, let's get into the interview with Bob Carwin. All right, welcome to another episode of Blame It on Buffett. This week, my guest is, what's his name? Bob Carwin. Bob Carwin, how are you?
I am fantastic. It is great to not see you and just be voice to voice with you.
Yeah, just voice to voice. That's how we roll here at Blame It on Buffett.
That's right. I don't know how to approach your show like vocally. Am I supposed to be like NPR where, well, you know, one of the things I really enjoy most about musicianship is the exploration of the human development and the internal waves that occur? Or am I like, hey, it's great to be here on a Monday morning with the zoo?
I mean, I would say maybe a little somewhere in between those two things.
Oh, okay.
You know, just be yourself if that's a thing that you could do.
In between. I don't know if I've ever been there. Let's try.
Have you ever been just at like a moderate, regular volume of speaking?
I don't. Like, it's like you ever listen to John Anderson sing? It sounds like whenever he's singing, somebody's turning the knob and the microphone. It's like, so. Like, yeah, doesn't all love go? I'll find it. I'll calibrate. I'm a man with, I have no control over my voice.
Luckily, the post-production sort of moderates wild noises a little bit. We can only hope. I've never had a guest quite like you before, so we'll see how the post-production handles that. But hopefully it can work some magic if you get too out of hand.
I will do my best.
I will say though, I think you have a great voice for podcasts because you have that like deep, low voice. It's very sort of soothing when you're not, you know, yelling. So I think that's the thing people like to hear. It sounds nice on a podcast.
Good. All right. Well, thank you for having me on the podcast.
Yeah, you're welcome. Now we'll just all talk really low the whole time. I can't really talk that low.
Just Spider Harrison for 2 hours. Hello, Spider Harrison.
Don't talk like that.
All right.
Anyway, so here you are on the podcast. And I honestly, I feel like you are one of the artists that I heard pretty early on in my career as a trop rock musician. I feel like you're one of the ones that I know pretty well. Like now I'm getting to know more people I'm talking to them on the podcast, which is really nice. But you were one of the ones that I kind of like was friends with fairly early on. So it's really great to have you. I wanted to have you, obviously, but now it's a perfect time because you have just released a new album.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, that is part of my strategy is to get into people early before they get to hear other people. You know, I like to be first, so I kind of set the tone, and that way I'm not judged against prior experiences. But what, let's see, where did we meet? Was that at Parrot Grande that we met for the first time?
I think so, probably, because you've played at Parrot Grande, I think, most of the years that I have attended, and that's been like, I think I started going like 10 years ago, maybe 9 or 10 years ago. So
yikes.
That was like pretty soon after I moved here, I think maybe within the first or second year that I went to Parrot Grande. So I think that's probably that where I saw you.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah. I mean, I'm really glad you're doing the podcast. It's a cool show. I've enjoyed listening. I listened to most of Jim Hain, but I think I've heard most of his stuff before. I was trapped in a minivan with Jim Hain once. I drove with Jim Hain in a minivan from Milwaukee, Wisconsin to Port Clinton, Ohio. And then we took the ferry across to Put In Bay and spent the weekend in Put In Bay. And then I got back in the van with him and we drove back to Chicago. So yeah, I spent my time with Jim Hain.
So you've heard literally every Jim Hain story there is to hear.
I don't think there's an end. No, it's a bottomless well of fascinating information. So, I mean, what was your show? 3.5 hours with Jim Hain?
I mean, honestly, it could have been. Like, I am happy to talk to people for a long time. And the only reason that I sort of try and wrap it up is because I kind of feel like maybe people don't want to listen to a podcast for 3 hours. I don't know, maybe they do, but I feel like that's a complaint you often see on the podcasting Reddit forums is like, this show's 3 hours. I'm not going to listen to that garbage or whatever.
That's right.
So I try to keep it somewhat close to an hour. That hasn't really been happening lately. Usually it's closer to like an hour and a half. But yeah, I could have easily talked to Jim Hain for probably like 5 hours. So you're welcome for cutting it short.
Outstanding.
But it just means that, you know, he can come back on another time and we'll have plenty of other things to talk about.
Jim Hain part two.
Yeah. I did sell you out a little bit on that podcast. I don't know if you got that far. About your bit that you do about how Jim Hain only has one dance move. Cause I was like, is it true that you only have one dance move? Because this is a lie, possible lie that Bob Carwin is perpetuating. And maybe you have more dance moves than that. He was like, no, that's pretty much it.
I'm surprised he admitted that it was a dance move in the first place.
Well, I think actually what he said was that he doesn't feel very comfortable on stage. So when he doesn't have his guitar to play, then he just feels awkward. And that's the thing that he does to stop from feeling awkward.
It is one of the greatest things on earth to watch Jim Hain on stage without his guitar, just running in place. It's fantastic.
That's what I think now we're just talking about Jim. This is just another Jim Hain podcast now. I mean,
he got us. He did it.
He's not even here. And the whole podcast is about him already. But one of the things that I like about Jim Hain is that he's the one that will tell you this, like he's not super comfortable on stage. Like he just sort of like fell into being a musician, but like he's not really, a showman in the way that a lot of musicians are. But that is like really makes him a special brand of his thing is, you know, really unique to him. And I like that. But your thing is also very unique to you. And I would argue that you're on the other end of the spectrum of being a showman. You're all about the show. One might say you're the greatest showman.
But you've also just said I'm on the spectrum. So either way.
Of showmanship, Bob Carwin.
Ah, there you go. Showmanship. Well, you know, what I've always tried to do when I play is, and this is going to sound really, really bad, but I always try to put on a show that if I were sitting in the audience, that's what I'd want to see. And aside from the fact that it's more Bob Carwin, I would like to see much more of myself. I used to go all the time. There was a place in Hermosa Beach I used to go to where they would have a patio outside. We'd go down there on a Sunday, you know, early afternoon, drink beers, and they'd have a guitar player out there. And I sat there and I was listening to the player sets, and they had kind of a consistent, I don't know, universe of people that they pulled from. And the set lists were fantastic. Just, you know, they were doing mostly covers, that kind of thing, but it was perfect for sitting at the beach, drinking beer, listening to music. And I said, man, if I was going to write a set list. This is what I would write. And that's the kind of show I enjoy seeing. So when I put on a show, I put on a show that if I were sitting in the audience, that's what I'd want to be seeing. And people who try to figure out what the audience wants and do it always kind of come across as corny or inauthentic. So, you know, I just do it for me because I'm the only judge. I don't try to guess what other people want to see. I do, you know, if I was sitting, me personally, I'm not talking about audiences, but me directly personally, if I was sitting there, what would I want to be seeing on that stage? And that's kind of what I try to put out. I'm entertaining essentially myself. I mean, there could just be a giant mirror in front of the stage facing back at me and I'd be completely fine.
Well, I think that's important because, I mean, I guess in the trap rock world, you're more likely to play a venue like a house concert or, you know, a more intimate event where people are really there to some, at least somewhat listen to you. But it seems like in the course of being a musician, you know, lots of people play at bars and other things where the audience might not necessarily be there to just listen to you and they might not really be paying attention. So
right.
It seems entertaining yourself is probably the most important thing because otherwise you're just going to be super bored for like 2 hours. But if you're like having a great time, no matter what, then it doesn't really matter if the audience is paying attention.
One of the biggest viruses in music is when everything starts to kind of sound the same and everybody starts to sound the same. And the reason for that is because people are trying to craft what they do to the audience. And, you know, pop is pop for a reason. It's the popular thing. It's homogenous. It's what everybody tends to lowest common denominator like. And musicians who do their own thing and stick with that voice and that kind of delivery or style or content or whatever, they come across as authentic. And that's what makes people different. Somebody's got a weird inflection in their voice. Instead of fixing it to make them sound like most other people, you roll with that and that makes you sound different as opposed to like everybody else. So when you get to the original music world, if you are trying to recreate Margaritaville over and over again, for example, everything you do is going to sound the same, but also everybody else who is trying to recreate Margaritaville is going to sound the same as themselves and the same as you and the same as everybody else who's trying to do that. Whereas if you come at it from a different angle, that's going to be your uniqueness. And if you get good at your uniqueness, then you find an audience that gravitates towards that instead of, you know, once Margaritaville fades, you've got to find another uniqueness. And that's not a thing. So that's really where you need to find people need to find their voice and people are scared to do that.
Well, and I think that's a good point because that really is in the tradition of Jimmy Buffett, right? Like he sort of just started doing his own thing. And early on, nobody really knew he was or cared about him. And he was like kind of trying to fit into the country, you know, at first, like his really early stuff is a lot more sort of that country feel. And then
he started out doing a straight up impression of Jerry Jeff Walker. And then he kind of found
himself. That's what I mean is like his country stuff was like, okay, well, there's a million country artists in Nashville and like whatever. But then once he sort of started doing his own thing and like became Jimmy Buffett in a way like the Jimmy Buffett we know now, that's when he sort of like got this following because it was like, oh, no one else is really doing this in that same way. And it seems like once he found that, it's sort of like, okay, well, this is just, I'm just going to write this and this is just how I want to do it and who I am, as opposed to being like, okay, well, I'm going to make it in the country scene or whatever. Then he really, that's when he really like got the following that are us or me. And I mean, not that I was alive then, but like he has continued, I think, to do that. I'm like, you know, he has a million albums and a lot of them are very different from each other. And a lot of them, you know, some fans don't like, some fans like, but he never really seems to be like, okay, well, I have to write Margaritaville again for every song, you know, which I like that because I love the fact that like a lot of his albums are so different in musical style, in theme, in the type of stories. So I feel like that is an important part of being a musician. And that's like one of the reasons why I love Jimmy Buffett and why the people that I love in the trap rock world are the people that I love is because they also have just sort of their own thing that's them. Like your music is all very much like I could probably listen to, you know, your music versus like Jim Haynes music versus like you know, Mike Nash's music or whatever. And I could pick out whose was whose just because everybody kind of has their own, has developed their own feel, because especially in such a small, like niche market, I think it would become really obvious if you just sound just like someone else. So I think that you definitely have a specific style.
It's the David S. Pumpkins philosophy. It's his own thing.
David S. Pumpkins. I haven't heard that reference in a while.
what's cool is when you get people who are so so comfortable with their voice in music that you can actually tell whose song it is if you've never heard it without even hearing them. Like if you hear a Jim Hayne record, like a Jim Hayne song, a new one that you haven't heard before, you'd probably be able to tell that it was Jim Hayne coming, or, you know, Mike Nash or whatever. So that's something that we try to develop. And, you know, sometimes people go into trends where everybody will use the same musicians or producer, and that might be hard to tell for a little while. But even so, you can, a lot of times you can tell from the song structure. You know, Jim Hayne's songs tend to be very like machine gun. He's got a very strong rhythm to his songs because that's how he plays the guitar and how he writes. Whereas Mike Nash's songs tend to be a little bit more funky, and mine tend to be a little bit more rock. And I think if you heard a song coming and you were to say, can you guess whose song this is from the intro before the lyrics start? There are a lot of people who you probably be able to tell who it is. And that's when you know you've gotten somewhere, when you've gotten somewhere for yourself, when you're finding out who you are. If people can tell from your song style who it is, then that's a really hard thing to accomplish.
It's a good point you mentioned about the production, because that was something I hadn't really, like, as someone that isn't a musician and doesn't like make albums, I'd never really thought too much about the production side of things. On this, the new album that you just put out, Donnie Brewer is actually the producer. And I didn't even know that that was a thing that he did until this. And then, the Trap Rock video that came out recently. So that's like a really interesting, does he produce his own albums too? Or like, how did that happen where you were like, hey, Donnie Brewer, like, do you want to produce my album?
So what's really fun is I getting to know Donnie over a while. So Donnie used to be a music producer in Christian rap, believe it or not. He used to produce Christian rap albums for artists. And he's got a long production background. He does produce all of his own stuff, and he's done a lot. He's done the Winnebago tapes, which were a set of duets that he's done with other people, and he produced all those songs. And I, you know, a lot of people don't realize what a producer does. You know, a lot of people think you write the songs, you work out all the parts, and then the producer just kind of captures it with good microphones. But the producer really is more akin to an editor in a manuscript, where they say, you know what, this idea isn't fully fleshed out here. Go back and fix this lyric. People don't realize that a producer has that kind of input, and should, because you don't know how to edit yourself. So you come in. Sometimes people will come in and just have an idea, and the producer will kind of push them in different directions. Well, let's try it as country. Let's try it as rock. Let's try it as this. And the producer says, well, maybe you want to move this lyric to here or something like that. And it's not really songwriting. It's more fixing the song to make it the best that it can be. And that's what a producer does. And then a producer will say, you know what? I think what really we need here is a triangle or a ukulele or whatever that you don't have in your band or your arsenal, but they do. They have an access to other musicians, and they bring that in and they throw that element in there that will improve your song. And that's what a producer's job is. Donnie has a great ear for that. And that's something that Jimmy Buffett has also had the benefit of. You know, Michael Utley is a tremendous producer, and he knows how to maximize when Jimmy comes in with a vocal and acoustic guitar, how to turn that into this massive, you know, stage arrangement. He does that. And it's getting from point A to point B that people don't understand that role in music and how important it is. But it can also be really, really terrible, because if you listen to like a lot of modern country music, I listened to the Key West Songwriters Festival online. I've never actually been to the Key West Songwriters Festival, but they broadcast a lot of things online. And if you listen to some of these people whose songs you think are, you know, bro country or modern country that sound that sound terrible. If you listen to the songwriter play it solo acoustic, the way they wrote it, you realize, oh, my dogs, you realize that the producer screwed it up with, you know, drum machines and all that other stuff. Let me get this dog outside. Hang on a second.
While Carwin is doing that, if you haven't seen his dog, it is super cute. And you should go to his Instagram because there is some adorable puppy photos on there that you can check out.
I'm coming.
Like, seriously, it's so cute.
Yeah, so I've got a four-month-old.
Bob Carwin, why aren't you posting more pictures of your dog? That's what the people want to see. So I was just telling people about how cute your puppy was.
I've got a four-month-old black lab, and I've got a nine-year-old Shiba Inu, and the nine-year-old can only take that four-month energy for so long. Yeah. So that's what, you know, you hear that barking in the background. It's, get away from me, get away from me. So I got to put her in the other room, let her have her own space. She's got her own den.
That's also how I feel when I'm around children. It's like 10 minutes. I'm like, all right, I'm tired now. Like, I can't do it.
That's right. That's exactly so right. So, you know, we were talking about production and stuff. And so what Donnie would do is, like, for example, there was one song that I had written. It's on the new album. It's called Can I Buy You a Beer? And it was kind of a wistful barroom thing about a guy who was trying to get a girl who was out of his league. And he was, you know, being romantic about it. But Donnie said, well, wait a minute, what if we take the chorus and just amp it up and make it like a honky tonk thing? I had no idea what he was talking about. And then he put it together. I was like, oh my goodness, that really works. And so it changed the song by adding this upbeat chorus that I hadn't really thought of. So, you know, people hearing the song from the outside, a lot of times, you know, people will hear the song from the outside after you release it and they'll have opinions on it. But this is somebody who's giving you the opinion before you release it and you can fix it and make it better. So that was an example there. And there was another song on the record that we ended up being a co-write called The Rum Helps a Little, where I had just sent him lyrics and he put the whole musical thing. I said, here's what I want it to sound like, but I'm going to let you just kind of run with it. And he put the whole music bed together and it's ridiculous. It's rap. And it's like, ain't going down till the sun comes up kind of thing. And so he put that all together and I couldn't have done it because I don't have that kind of musical library.
Yeah, I had no idea, that the extent, I guess, to what the producer does, like everything you just described, like I kind of, like you said, I kind of thought it was like, oh, here's all the songs and the producer kind of edits it together, maybe helps decide like what instruments to use or whatever. But like when I was listening to the new album, you know, there's like some like electric guitar riffs on there and like some other stuff. And I was just like, is Bob Carwin doing all of these? Like I've never seen you play anything except like acoustic guitar and ukulele. So when you have all those other parts, like you have other people's, obviously if you have like a woman singing, that's not you. I don't think maybe right. You do a really good impression of a woman singing, but
no, that's Robin Tricker.
Oh, great. That's awesome.
Well, you know, what I'll tell you is this, there's a famous story about the song Pretty Woman by Roy Orbison. It's got that famous introduction, that kind of that guitar lick. So when they were recording that song, they had session musicians. Roy Orbison didn't have a band. He was just a solo guy. And they brought in a bunch of Nashville cats to come record the record or wherever they recorded it, maybe down in Sun Studios, wherever they recorded it. But the guy who laid that down, the record producer said, we need an intro for this. You know, can you put an intro down? So the guy went out into the hallway for like 10 minutes and figured it out and came back in and laid it down and got paid $50. And that's what made that song famous. Or if you listen to Boat Drunk's Hollow Man, that harmonica intro that Howie does at the beginning, that sets the tone for the entire song. But Mike didn't write that part. That's something that Howie wrote. So that kind of thing is – it adds. And when you've got people who have that kind of skill, like I can play guitar and I can play lead guitar, but I don't have that library of licks and riffs in my head that somebody who plays lead guitar does. You know, there's another famous story of the Beatles, While My Guitar Gently Weeps. The guitar solo in that is by Eric Clapton. And somebody asked George Harrison to say, hey, you're the lead guitar player for the Beatles. Why did Eric Clapton play the solo on one of your songs? And he said, well, when your best mate is Eric Clapton, you let him play the solo.
Yeah.
So in this particular thing, yeah, Donnie played all the guitars because he's a much, much better rock guitar player than I am. I just don't have that vocabulary. I've got folk and I've got country and I can play leads. I've played lead on many of my albums. But this one, it was better to just let Donnie Brewer be Donnie Brewer.
How do you go about, so it's clearly a very important decision then who's producing your album. Like, do you listen to things that they've produced before and then decide, is it album to album? Like you think, oh, this person might be really good to produce this album, but this person, you know, the, based on how you want the album to feel, like, do you have different,
well, I'd worked in the past with a guy named Kevin Johnston, and he forced me to find a new producer because he got out of the business. I don't know. I didn't drive him out or anything, but he ended up, he just basically turned off his phone and stopped returning his calls. He produced albums for me, for Danny Hoy and Paul Roush and Jake Thomas, a bunch of other people, Brittany Kingery. He produced all those people. Then all of a sudden he just disappeared. So he was gone and I needed a new producer, and Donnie had done some stuff where I heard his records. I was like, man, these sound really good. And I like his energy and his approach to things. So I thought we'd get along really well. And he's trying to now move into that production kind of profession. So he was like, hey, this is a good opportunity. I've got all my songs written. I'm ready to go. And there was a dead spot in his schedule. So let's do a record. And it was really funny. You talk about, you know, are we a good match or how do you choose a producer? I was walking my dog and I was listening to internet radio, and this song came on. I'd been listening for like 20 minutes over the course of the walk, and the song came on with this acoustic guitar intro, and I went, oh, that's it. That's the acoustic guitar sound that I want on my record. I'm going to tell Donnie about it so we can, you know, so we can look it up and look at the settings. And I looked at my phone and it was a Donnie Brewer song.
Well, that worked out nicely.
That I didn't know the song. I just heard the guitar. I was like, oh my God, that's exactly what I want. And it turned out to be the guy who I had hired to be my producer. So it worked out well.
Well, one of the songs that I really like is Can You See the Moon? Because it has like a really sort of like old timey, like vintage feel. It's got that like sweet kind of old timey uke. Was that like how you pictured the song to begin with? Or was that more of something that came out in production?
No, that was exactly what I was thinking. Well, so originally I had written that song as a straight up impression of Sonny Jim. I thought that Sonny Jim would be great for that. And I was trying to just do him. And so I played it on guitar because my son moved to college and he took my uke with him. So I don't have one right now. So I couldn't do it on the uke, but I played it on guitar. And then when I was strumming it on the guitar, it just sounded exactly like Monkey River Town by Keith Sykes. So
we need to mix this up.
We need to change the production a little bit so it's not the same song. Monkey River Town, can you see the moon? Monkey River
Town. Oh, yeah, that's a good
song
too.
So, but yeah, that kind of Hawaiian slack key guitar kind of thing was exactly what I was doing. And that's, you know, another thing. You bring in a guy who can play that stuff. I can't play it. So if I was going to record it myself, I wouldn't have gotten that. Brought in somebody who can play that kind of style like Donnie can, and it fit together. I love that song.
Yeah, I really love that song too. It's one of my faves on the album.
Oh, fave rave.
This is what I posted. Like, I shared your post from yesterday about how the album was dropping, and I shared it to my page and was like, listen, Carwin's going to be on the podcast this weekend. If you want to know what we're talking about when I'm like, oh, this is my favorite song, this is my favorite song, then you better listen now, because otherwise you won't know what songs I'm talking about. So
that's right.
You said something which I think was the kind of a joke about like writing a Sonny Jim song, but do you ever write songs that you think like, oh, I could really see another like fellow trap rock artist doing this, and like maybe they would be interested in the song? Like, do you ever write songs, maybe not like purposefully for another person, but like you've written it and it's like, oh, I could really picture this person doing this a lot better? And then
yeah, that actually, like, do you that tell actually them does
about
happen.
It or
yeah, like, so that- like on my last record, I've got a song called Bearable Hours, and when I wrote it, I just looked at it and I started laughing. I was like, man, I just wrote a Tom Shepard song, because, you know, it's his style. And I think maybe listening to him, because I don't normally write like that. Like, Tom Shepard is a Nashville guy, and those Nashville guys, what they like to do is they brainstorm titles, and they get a good title, they tend to write the song around it. I tend not to do that. I'm more of I grab the guitar and strum, and I usually start writing once I get the first line of a song comes into my head. But that one came from the title. And so I wrote that one from the title, and it came out that way. I said, man, that's a Tom Shepard song, but I knew he wouldn't record it. recently I had another idea for a song that when I thought about it, I said, nah, that's a Brent Burns song. It's 100% a Brent Burns song. So I called Brent and I pitched it to him and he liked it. So he and Bill White actually finished it up and recorded it. It's going to be on Brent's next album. And then I had a song that I co-wrote with Mike Miller on his solo album called Safe Place to Fall, which, you know, we had the idea and it was Mike, you know, like that Hollow Man, kind of the epic storytelling sort of song is more him than me. If I were to play that song in my set, it would sound weird, but for him, it fits perfectly because that's his style. So yeah, that does happen where you're writing something and you realize, nah, this isn't me. It's not my voice, but I really like the song, and you'll pitch it to other people.
Yeah, because I talked about this on a previous episode, but I never really realized how much sort of like co-writing goes on behind the scenes. You know, like I would just listen to albums and be like, oh, this is, you know, Mike Nash's album. So like he wrote all these songs. That's how it goes in my mind. But like then like when you look into it, it's like, oh, actually he co-wrote a bunch of them, you know, with a someone else, or someone might write a song and then another person ends up totally playing it. And that part is like really interesting to me because like I'm trying to learn music, but it's a struggle. But like the most
interesting Queen's
parts
Chicken songs is great.
That's not why I brought this up, but thank you. Like I'm more interested in like things sort of come into my head and I'm like the sort of the title thing, like you were talking about, like that song came from me and Pam were just walking in Key West and like we were like, why are there so many chickens here? And we didn't know, so we just like made up our own story about why they were there. And those kinds of things, like especially in the course of like being at Trapper events or like living in that world, you're like, oh, that would make a great song title, or oh, that would make a great song lyric. And I'm not really equipped to like be a musician, but it's like, okay, well maybe like there's some room out there for like, if you sort of think things up, like someone might want to do it. So that's good to know.
Well, no, that's actually a thing, because you know, one of the reasons that co-writing is a thing is because people have different perspectives and angles that, you know, when the Beatles would write songs, generally one of them would write the bulk of the song and then the other one would write what they call the middle eight. People call it the bridge, where if you listen to a lot of Beatles songs, the bridge sounds very different from the rest of the song. And that's because McCartney would write the part and Lennon would write the bridge, or vice versa. So when it comes to different perspective and views on stuff, having another angle or another input or another set of life experiences that feed into it really does help. So if you've got this idea and all these people are throwing ideas out, it can work. And sometimes it gets in the way. And me, I'm terrible at co-writing. I'm not really, really good at it. But there's people who do it, like, for, you know, Aaron Schurz. Every song is a co-write because that's the way he was brought up in Nashville. You grab somebody and say, hey, let's go write the song together. You know, there are some people who, like in Nashville, that's just it. You never hear somebody doing – when somebody does what they call a solo write in Nashville, it's a big deal because you never hear that. Whereas, you know, in trap rock and singer-songwriter land, James Taylor, stuff like that, most of them are solo writes because it's some whiny dude on an acoustic guitar sitting in their, you know, living room at 3 o'clock in the morning after, you know, breaking up with somebody, writing a song. But when it comes to, you know, country music, there's a lot of input because it has to be airtight. It has to be, you know, what other metaphors? Rock solid. It has to be all those kinds of things. You know, there just can't be any cracks in it. And by having a songwriter duo or team, all these different people looking at it, each person is looking for different weaknesses in the song and patching that hole. That's what you get from songwriting a lot of times.
Yeah. Now that you're saying that, I feel like the people that I have heard talk about co-writing songs the most recently are ones that sort of have like a Nashville background, not so much like you or like Mark Mulligan or, you know, the sort of like solo, like real trop rock guys. It's more like kind of the country influence people. So that makes a lot of sense. And I guess if you're just all in Nashville together, right? Like it's easy to just like get together and write a song.
Well, that's the other thing. You know, I was talking to Donnie about this when we were doing the record, that when you'd see these songs of, you know, Waylon Jennings be name checking Willie Nelson and you know, all these other people in his songs, Kris Kristofferson, these guys, you know, Waylon, Willie and me and all that kind of stuff. That's because these guys used to go hang out. They lived all together in town. And when they weren't gigging or playing shows on their own on the road, the four of them would just go to a bar with Johnny Cash and they'd sit there and they'd shoot heroin and drink beer and blow stuff up and just hang out. So these guys had a life together and then they go their separate ways and make their records. It creates a different kind of camaraderie than when people are just, you know, they fly into, you know, Phoenix and then fly out the next day. You don't really get to hang out and live with those people. And that's something that old kind of outlaw country had that a lot of other music genres don't have.
Yeah. It's like now in trop rock, that's like Sonny Jim and John Patty are like, because they like live pretty close. And so they like play a ton of like, all like half their virtual shows online have been them together, you know?
More specifically, it was Sonny Jim and Jim Morris. Those guys used to go out together all the time and they would play together and Sonny Jim would play on Jim Morris's songs. They'd do duo stuff and they play back and forth. And those two guys were great friends and they used to hang out because they lived in close proximity. They were good friends off the stage as well as on the stage, and their stuff really cross-pollinated, which is why, you know, Sonny Jim can do those songs so well because they were such good friends. You know, there's one of my all-time favorite records is a Todd Snyder record where he does a full set of Jerry Jeff Walker songs because he palled around, was basically Jerry Jeff's protege for several years and drug carrier. And they would do shows together and he got to know these songs inside and out. I decided to record his own versions of them because he was so close to them. It wasn't just, hey, we're putting together a Rolling Stones tribute record. Would you like to do one? It was he hung out with this guy and knows him personally and was able to get his direct vibe on these songs. And, you know, Sonny Jim and Jim Morris were that kind of relationship. So when he plays those songs and, you know, John Patty was in Jim Morris's band. So he's also part of that same circle. And Jimmy Pappas was in that band as well. So when those guys do those shows and they play those songs, there's a connection there that you don't get with somebody else doing them.
Yeah. It's really, one of my biggest regrets is that like, I didn't really learn about Jim Morris until after he died. Like my early exposure to the trop rock world was really like the people that I saw at house concerts. So that was like sort of more of the West Coast people, and maybe like Texas-y people. But I hadn't, it's not until like a little more recently in the last few years that I've really started, actually kind of since going to Meeting of the Minds, I guess, where you really get a lot more musicians from everywhere, that I started sort of learning about all of the trop rock musicians that are out there. And so I never really, you know, knew about him or like, I've never, like never saw him play or anything. But like, he really seems like he was really like a huge staple and influence in the trop rock community.
He's one of the Mount Rushmore. He's one of the originators of the genre. You know, there's a big misconception in the history of trop rock. I've been in it from close to the beginning. A lot of people don't realize that. I was really one of the first ones in there. But the origination of trop rock music, what became trop rock that they ended up calling it, was not trying to sound like Jimmy Buffett, you know, and that came later with cover bands. There was a band in San Diego called Buffed Out that was the same time as Scott Nickerson and these people doing Buffett tribute bands. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about people writing songs from that same perspective and what that came into. You know, I've always said that trop rock originated with songs about Jimmy Buffett, like Don Middlebrook's song, I Stole Jimmy Buffett's TV Guide, was one of the first songs I can remember that actually name checks Jimmy Buffett. It's a first song about Jimmy Buffett as opposed to trying to sound like Jimmy Buffett. And Jim Morris never tried to sound like Buffett. But he was influenced by that kind of colorful character style, like Carl Hiaasen's writing, that kind of thing. Those characters that come out of those swamps in Florida or those kinds of things. If you listen to it, his characters are really fully developed. Same thing Jim Hayne does, same thing Buffett's early songs did. If you go back and listen to like Ace or any of those songs where he's knocked down in his hammock, or Captain Tony, all these characters that come out of the songs. You know, when you ride your bike around Key West, it's like riding through an early Jimmy Buffett album. You see Fausto's Get Some Chocolate Milk, and you see Woman Going Crazy on Caroline Street. You see that. And these are real things and real people and real characters. And that was Jim Morris's real talent, was to be able to take a short story and put it to interesting music, and doing it with that kind of beachy Caribbean influence in the music. Those are the factors that made Jimmy Buffett's song so great. And that's what made Jim Morris part of the bridge into creating this trop rock genre.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, like you said, trop rock, and I've talked about this before, but it's really more about,
don't repeat yourself, that Aaliyah.
Share. Listen, not everybody listens to every episode, so whatever.
Sorry, I wasn't listening.
If you've heard me before, say this before, you could stop me, Bob Carwin. But like it's really about sort of like writing about kind of a lifestyle, or like kind of escapism. Like, it's not like every song has to be about the beach or every song has to be Margaritaville, but it's sort of like that storytelling, like escapism, that ties trop rock together as a genre. Like, it's really heavily based in, I think, like the storytelling aspect. And that kind of goes along with what you're saying about like Jim Morris writing those kinds of like character stories. And I think that is what like brings everyone together, because obviously, especially now, like there's a ton of like people that are coming from sort of the countryside of things and all of this, but something is connecting everyone to be considered like trop rock, even though like if you look at a lot of people's songs, it's not like, oh, this is about the tropics per se. And obviously like you have some songs that are about the tropics, but like you have lots of songs that aren't, but they still, you know, a lot of them still evoke like that sort of like escapist, or like telling a story about like getting away, you know, about doing something.
I want to circle back to something that you said, because it was an interesting point. When you're talking about Buffett and people coming up and kind of entering into the trop rock universe, one of the mistakes that I think a lot of people make, they miss the point in trying, I've said this before, people trying to recreate Margaritaville because they want to be like Jimmy Buffett. Right. But Margaritaville isn't the song. It's, for me, it's Fins is the song that, if you're going to try to be Jimmy Buffett, or you're going to try to recreate Jimmy Buffett's catalog, and you want to start with something super popular, Fins, because you talk about the energy, that song, that da-da-da-da-da-da, that whole huge buildup, that's the rock. And Jimmy Buffett was actually always more of a rock band than a country band. And that song, the energy, and then the story in that song, there's a lot of character in there, and there's a lot of storytelling in that song that's not in Margaritaville or a lot of the other songs. So of the, you know, of the famous, of the base nine that he has to do at every show, Fins is the one that really, I think, is what most summarizes what's great about Jimmy Buffett's music. And the people who are able to tap into that, as opposed to the, you know, super jangly, slow singer-songwriting Margaritaville thing, you know, Margaritaville is a really sad song if you listen to it closely. Yeah. And whereas Fins
is
really
developed over time into something different than
it's developed into a wedding band song. Yeah. But but Fins is the rock end of it, and it's a good story, it's a good beat, it's got a good guitar solo in it. That's a rock song. And that's the one that I wish more people would focus on from the blanket career than Margaritaville. Kind of things evolve over time.
Fins also has like the original audience participation. Like now the audience has like created audience participation for Margaritaville, but originally there was no, right? Like Fins was really the one that like got the audience involved. So like, that also, just from like the showmanship, like going to a concert, like having a fun time, like being involved in the song, Fins was like the original one. And like now people have added sort of audience participation parts to other Jimmy Buffett songs. But like that, like I watched one of the, they're doing those like Jimmy Buffett concert replays on Saturdays of old concerts. And I watched the one this last Saturday, and it was weird to hear people not doing like the salt part, because I, you know, when was the last time like you went to a show and people didn't do that? And it kind of reminded
before that?
Me. What?
The show that you were watching was before that started?
Yeah, it was from like the early 90s or something. And it was just like reminded me like, oh yeah, like that wasn't always, it's not like Jimmy wrote that into the song. Like it became a thing over time. But like the Finns thing is, you know, that's like part of the song, like integral part of the song, I feel like. So
yeah, exactly. You know, the whole thing where he puts up the shark fin on his head and all that other kind of stuff, that came from that song, not Margaritaville. So that's the part that I've always, my music has always been in trop rock, more on the rock end than the trop thing, which segues into the other point you were making about how a lot of people write, it's not so much about the tropics, but it's interesting. If you break it down, you've got your Florida people, you've got your Texas people, and then you've got your West. And then, you know, the people in the North are kind of scattered around, you know, like in the Midwest are a little bit scattered around in their perspective. But the people who are from Florida or in Florida, they tend to write about Key West and the Caribbean. In the Gulf area, they tend to write a little bit more about the Gulf Coast and that side, the mainland of Mexico. And then on the West Coast, people tend to write about Baja and Hawaii, and they all mean the same thing. But the places that they reference, like Rob Mel's songs, are all about Hawaii, but it's just as tropical as people who are writing about, you know, the Caribbean. And but these are the places when you live in California, your access to the Caribbean isn't the British Virgin Islands; it's Hawaii because it's on that side. And you know, so the perspective of what is tropical depends on your perspective. If you grew up in California, Mexico was your tropical. It's not that, but it's the same feel, which is also why you see guys tend to sing about tequila when their version of the tropics is Mexico, as opposed to rum when their version of the tropics is the Caribbean. It's an interesting reality of people's experience.
Yeah, because you know, you're not writing, it's easier to write about stuff that you know about. So if you're going to those places, like, yeah, it's much more natural to like, you're having those experiences. So to write a song.
Well, you should
about-
write about what you know about instead of trying to make it up, which a lot of people do.
Right. But you could, I think you could tell, right? When it's like, so like, actually, this is a perfect segue into your single from the new album, Alan the Taxi Man, because only someone that has taken a taxi ride on Tortola could have written that song. Like, you, even if you like heard a story, you couldn't really write, because I have also taken a taxi ride on Tortola in my life, several. And so like, you can tell when somebody has really experienced the thing that they're trying to write about versus like, oh, I heard it's crazy to, you know, the taxis or whatever are crazy. Like, it's a very obvious, I think, I mean, maybe not everything, but especially for if the listener has experienced that thing, it's definitely easy to tell if the musician has actually experienced the thing or not. And I really love that song too, because it is, it's so like spot on. Like, I just, it's so evocative of what that experience is actually like. And it's really catchy. Do you want to talk a little bit about like how that song came to be and like your actual taxi ride?
So, yeah, we went down, a friend of ours was turning 40 and she organized a private catamaran trip through the British Virgin Islands. She went and hired a captain out of Atlanta, and he needed sea hours to maintain his captain's license. So he came down and he piloted the catamaran for us, and we lived aboard the catamaran for, I forget how long it was, like a week and a half or something like that. We went to all the different islands down there, and one of the stops on the trip was Tortola. And the way I got to know the driver, you know, everybody has their driver. And if you don't know the trick, if you go to the islands and you get a taxi driver, give the guy $20 and he'll slip you his cell phone number and you could call him anywhere. He'll be your personal Uber. That guy will drive you anywhere you want to go at any time, night or day. And that's a line in the song. But what happened was we stopped. We were going to get provisions for the boat. So he took us to this farmer's market. And we went to this field across the street from a school, and there was a farmer's market out there, and there was this DJ playing music that I'd never heard before. Like, it wasn't quite reggae. It wasn't quite ska. It was and I was asking him about it, and he said, it's fungi music, F-U-N-G-I. It's a style of music they have in Tortola. And the band was called the Lashing Dogs. And I guess on Tortola, the Lashing Dogs were like Bon Jovi in Tortola, but nobody heard of them anywhere else. And they were really unique to this island, and everybody there knew them. They had broken up before this point, but I was like, that is so cool. It's a type of music I'd never heard before. It's really unique to this island. I like it. I got to get some. So I said, Alan, man, where can I get some Lashing Dogs? And he goes, I take you, man. And we get in the van. We pile into the van after we buy all our Scotch bonnet peppers and everything. And we drive to this, it's like a mini department store. And the guy gets out of the taxi with me, and he walks me through the store all the way to the back. And he knows the guy who's working the music stand in the back. And he says, hey, hook my man up with some Lashing Dogs. And so the guy goes through and he tries to pull something else out. And he's like, no, that's not it. That's not it. Get that stuff. And then, so they went through and they got me like three CDs of music. And I went back and I listened to it. And so that song is actually in the style of a Lashing Dogs song. If you look them up on YouTube, Lashing Dogs, you can hear, the triangle and the mm-hmm. machine gun guitar style. We lifted that right out of that style of music to more authentic. And all of those things, like he said, one day we're driving around. We were there for like 3 days, and he was our driver the whole time. And there was one time we wanted roti because that's what you got to eat when you're in Tortola. He's like, I take you to Roti Queen. And it's like down this alley in the back, and you go there and it's just, there aren't any tourists there, but we had, we'd gotten to know the guy well enough. He's taking us to the place where the locals go. Like, all these lines out of the song are things that really happened. And you have that unique relationship. There was one time we called the guy up, and he was painting his deck, and he came and picked us up in the van and took us over to this bar and hang out and had lunch with us. So everybody who has gone to those islands and has taken the time to get to know people, because that's the fun of going, everyone's got an experience with Alan. So I had to write a song about it. It took me a long time. It took me like 4 years for it to bubble up. But just when I hit the phrase Alan the Taxi Man, I was like, oh, there we go. We got a song here.
That's a sweet spot.
That was it.
Yeah, it's one of the greatest things is if you befriend the locals, like, they all know a guy, like, whatever it is that you want to do. It's like, oh, I know a guy. I got a guy for that. So like, yeah, if you're in like the islands, like the BVI, like, just befriend a local somehow. Like, your taxi guy is a great way to do that. I also have one time. So part of my experience there is I went on this study abroad thing where I like was part of the crew of like a sailing vessel in the Caribbean. And on the way back, there was this opportunity to, they were going to refit the boat after my semester, like haul it out of the water, repaint it, like do all of that. And they were like, listen, anyone who was on this trip, like the educational part, if you want to stay and just be like staff to help fix up the boat, you can. And I was like, and they're like, and we're going to pay you. It's like, right, so I get to stay in the Caribbean for an extra month and you're going to pay me to do it. Yes, please. So I did that. But what that meant was like, I had to change my flight and all the stuff that I had planned to get back from the Caribbean to the States. And so what ended up happening was like, I had to just find somewhere to stay one night after I left the ship, because my flight was the next day. And so I like ended up staying at just like somebody's, it was kind of like someone's house, like just like a nice lady, local on the island had like a extra building or something that had like a couple rooms in it. And so that was like where I ended up staying. But also she was like, sort of just like took me under her wing immediately and was like, oh, like, okay, here's where you should go to eat for dinner. Here's where you should do this, you know? And I was like,
right,
this is perfect. Like, this is the kind of thing you wouldn't necessarily get at, like, if you stayed at a bigger hotel or, you know, if you don't interact like with the local people that live there at all. But it's so awesome to just like, to get to find out like the local spots because you've befriended someone. And yeah, like your taxi guy is a great way to do that. So I think in addition to being a fun song, it's also great advice for if you go to visit the BVI, like, get a good taxi guy and it will make your trip so much better.
Exactly, 100%. You know, there are so many people who they go abroad, but they live at home abroad. Like they'll travel somewhere and they'll look for a McDonald's or whatever. Like they try to live the same life that they have at home when they're there, instead of kind of giving in to the way it works wherever you are. And the giving into it is the best part when you find out that kind of stuff. You know, everybody, like you said, everybody knows a guy. You've got to get to know somebody to know the guy. You can't just live in your little bubble. And there's some places it's really hard to do that. Like if you go to Jamaica, it's really hard to do that because if you leave a resort, it's kind of dangerous. But there are some places where it's easier. And Tortola is one of those. Going through the BVIs, all the different islands, there are great places to do that. And I can't wait till the next time I get to go back to see like Joost Van Dyke. Oh, one of the greatest places on the planet.
I agree. Oh, are you a Joost Van Dyke person? I feel like I'm a Joost Van Dyke person.
Well, so I actually asked, I went down, there's a lady who has a fish shop down the beach from the Soggy Dollar. And I went in there and I told her, I said, how do you say it? How do you guys say it? And she said Joost. And I thought she was messing with me. So I decided I'm going to go with Joost.
Okay, good. Because I also asked a local person and they said Joost. So that's why I started saying it. But I see you're just being, you know, doing your own thing.
I'm being provincial. Well, like on the new record, I've got a cover of Vahevala by Loggins and Messina.
Let's talk about that.
If you listen to it, I was so I'm the current artist of the month on Radio Trop Rock, and they've been playing a bunch of my songs. And then Eric Babin this morning, I was listening to it. He happened to play the Loggins and Messina version of it. I was like, you jerk! That's on my record. I'm the artist of the month. They got to play my version of it, but. One of the things that on the original version, one of the differences between their version and mine is they say Vahevala and I say Vahevala because I think that's how it should be pronounced, even though it's a fictional place. I'm correcting the pronunciation of the guy who wrote a song about a fictional place.
That is such a Bob Carwin thing to do.
Yeah. So it's like Rob Mell does a version of Over the Rainbow, and he does Iz's version of Over the Rainbow, but he tells a story about how he had to get permission from the family to do the song. And and one of the things they kind of require in that Hawaiian music culture is if you're going to cover somebody's song, you've got to make it different. And he, you know, they said to him, well, Rob, how are you going to change it up? And he said, I'm going to get the lyrics right. And it's like, oh man, because Iz completely butchers the lyrics of Over the Rainbow when he does his version of it. If you listen to like the Judy Garland version versus his, he gets the lyrics completely wrong. And I almost think that's why he started going into the other. So why there was a medley, because he probably forgot the lyrics in the middle. But so it's one of those things like, you know what? I really think this should have been pronounced Vahevala. So that's the way I'm going to go with it.
Well, that's probably how I'm going to pronounce it now, because I think I had heard that song before, maybe like once, but I definitely will be hearing the Bob Carwin version a lot more now. So
I swear it's like a Trop Rock Bohemian Rhapsody. Yeah, it's like a Trop Rock Bohemian Rhapsody. It's huge. There's so much in there.
I think we talked about this a little bit offline, but I'd like to talk about it a little more now, because I sort of picture you as a guy who's like kind of disdainful of covers a little bit. I know you do very specific covers, and you brought up like, oh, you actually have covers on almost every album, which I guess I hadn't even realized, because maybe I didn't even know all the songs and didn't know they were covers. But you still, you know, are very sparing with what covers you choose. So how do you go about deciding if you're gonna like what you're gonna do as a cover?
It's not that I'm disdainful of covers at all. I love doing. I mean, I spent a long, long time in the beginning of my career as a cover band, basically. You know, I'd play for 4 hours and I'd just do straight covers, because I'd played in places where if you played an original, people throw stuff at you. And I've done those bar gigs for my entire career. And I used to be a human jukebox. I mean, I don't know how familiar you are with Scotty Bryan from Florida, but that guy's a human jukebox. He knows every song, and he plays every trop rock song and every rock song. Jerry Gontang from San Diego is the same way. The guy's an encyclopedia of lyrics and chords and that kind of thing. So I'm absolutely not disdainful of it. It's more of a matter of when I play a show now, people are hiring me because they want to hear the originals more than hear me play Brown Eyed Girl. You know, there's people who do that, and there's people who do it much better than I do in recreating. There's people who meticulously recreate these covers, and that's their thing, tribute kind of songs. And I don't do that anymore, because I've sort of lost my touch for it. So now when I do covers, it's more of a matter of I'm trying to work it into my set of originals than being a party band. And that's, it's a really difficult distinction to make. And if you do too many covers in a set, then you become a cover band, as opposed, a cover band who has originals, as opposed to an original band who throws in a cover. You know, when you see a band that goes out
there, I guess maybe that's, maybe disdainful was, oh, sorry. I was going to say, I just, maybe disdainful was the wrong word, but I feel like if you, like, I think I've heard you sort of do a rant before about, like, if you are, you should either sort of stick to being more of a, like, if you're going to be a cover band, that's great. But like, if you're an original artist, like, don't do too many covers.
Let me give you the definitive story. So I was playing I was playing at Camp Land in San Diego for the San Diego Parrot Head Club anniversary party. I play at it every year, and it's a tremendous event. And it's this huge outdoor stage that overlooks the bay, and it's a beautiful setting, and it's at the beach, and there's bands all day long, that kind of thing. And I got up on stage, and I was doing a, I think it was a 45-minute set. And I've been playing for about 30 minutes into the set, solo acoustic on the stage by myself, no drum tracks or anything. I was just playing guitars and singing and doing what I do. And I'd been playing for about 30 minutes. I did all original songs for 30 minutes. And this lady walks up to the front of the stage. And the stage is tall. It's like a 5 foot high off the ground stage. And I was standing there, and she walks over to the front of the stage, and she's waving at me like there's a lost child in the audience or something. So right in the middle of my set, I'm like, this has to be really important. So I left the microphone. I went over and I bent down to talk to her because I couldn't really hear her. And she said, "Can you play Layla?" And I lost my mind. I was like, first of all, you've been sitting here all day. Of all of the songs you could ask me to play, why that one? What makes you think that anybody on this stage all day long would even know Layla? It's a Parrot Head event. Of all of the songs you could pick. And then I said, I've been playing up here for 35 minutes playing all original songs. What makes you think I'm going to play a cover song right now in the middle of my set? I'm not taking requests of other people's music in the middle of my set. And then I reached into my pocket, and I had I keep my CDs in my pocket. I keep one of each so I can reference them in, like, as a set list. But I happened to pull them out. I said, "Lady, I've got 6 CDs of original music." And I throw them out into the audience one by one by one by 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And I said, "And you want me to play Layla? Are you kidding me?" And I got about halfway through it, and I realized that I'm standing there on the microphone in this concert sound arena with all these people looking at me, and I'm just yelling at this lady. And I'm like, oh my God, that I kind of lost my mind for a minute. And then I looked down, and next to where she was sitting, there was an empty seat, and next to where she was sitting, there was her, I guess, her husband. And I looked over at him to kind of as a barometer, and that guy is laughing his ass off. So I was like, okay. Then I just kind of leaned into it, and I just went off on this lady. And then after I finished that, you know, she went and sat back down, and I played, I think, Big Rudy, the King of Karaoke, and the husband came up and put a beer on the stage for me. but that, so in that context is more what I'm talking about. Like, clearly not a cover band. And if you want to hear covers, there are people who are going to be on the bill. Like every one of these Parrot Head shows, there's a cover band. They hire one who does tremendous cover songs. And it's not that it's a bad thing. It's that that's their job. But if you want to hear their originals, you know, if you go to see a Jimmy Buffett show just to hear him play Brown Eyed Girl, you're an idiot.
Yeah, I agree.
Because first of all, his version of it is awful. But second, if you're there to hear him do cover songs, what are you doing spending $250 a ticket to listen to him play Brown Eyed Girl that you can go to literally any bar and hear somebody play? So that's more what I'm talking about in the balance of covers and things like that. Like Jimmy and the Parrots play, and they're a cover band, and they've got originals. But Jimmy and the Parrots are a cover band. And when you hire them, they're going to play cover songs for you. They're upbeat. They're energetic. They do them in a fun way. And they drop in their originals here and there. Like every, you know, 6, 7 songs, you'll hear an original. And that's their role. But if you go see a singer-songwriter on, you know, Duval Street during Meeting of the Minds, and that dude is sitting there playing, you know, Sweet Caroline, it drives me insane. There was the Put In Bay Songwriters Festival is every week. There's a week every year in Key West. And I was watching it online because I know some of these guys. And there was a dude sitting in Captain Tony's playing Sweet Caroline. I'm like, you flew all the way down here from Ohio to play Sweet Caroline?
I think that probably people fall into the trap of like, oh, if these people don't know me super well, they don't know like my originals, like, you worry about, are you pleasing the crowd enough? Like, are they happy enough just listening to songs they don't know? And then, it's probably kind of like an insecurity thing, right? Like,
If 100%.
I throw in Sweet Caroline, like everybody's going to know it. Everybody's going to sing along. Everybody's going to love it.
Everybody has one of those.
That's the other thing is if you know a musician, you know, like they're like, right. Like you, people who go to see you play are going to like hear Ring of Fire and they're going to want to hear Ring of Fire. But that's the established one that you do. And there's a whole bit, you know, you got the kazoos and everything. So that version of it and the version that you do has become a Bob Carwin song in a way that like people are like, oh, well, that's a song we know that Bob Carwin plays. We know we can request that. We know that we can kazoo along or whatever. That's a lot different than just like going up and requesting any random song that is a cover song.
you've hit on it exactly right down to the pinhead, which is that song has now become a Bob Carwin song in my set, as opposed to me playing other people's music. That song is now for that audience. That song is associated, that version of it specifically with me. And that I think is a successful cover when you could do that. And every musician's got one, whether it's a cover song that, you know, you've made your own song. Like John Reno does a song called Magic Chair. That's a cover song by Del Suggs, but it became his song. And, you know, as opposed to just being a random cover band, that's the difference. And also the other double secret is that every musician has one song in their back pocket that if it's not going well, they can always throw that song out there and you're good. And for a lot of people, that's Brown Eyed Girl. I always used to tell people, if I'm playing a show and I play Brown Eyed Girl, that's the signal to let you know that I think it's not going very well and I need to get the audience back on my side.
Yeah. So that's why that guy was playing Sweet Caroline. He was like panicking.
Yeah.
Oh no, quick, play something they're going to know. This kind of is circling back to something that we talked about quite a while ago at this point, but the songs about Jimmy Buffett, right, versus being like, oh, I'm writing a Trap Rock song, but like a song that directly is about Jimmy Buffett. And I've mentioned this before, but I have a playlist on Spotify called Every Trap Rock Artist Has One, because a lot of them do. And yours is the Never Met the Man song, which is a great song about Jimmy Buffett without ever actually mentioning Jimmy Buffett directly, which I love. Is that true? Have you never met the man, or is that just for show?
No, it's very, very true. I've never met Jimmy Buffett. And the biggest irony of that song is that it is one of the only songs by me that they play on Radio Margaritaville.
I mean, because it's like about Jimmy Buffett, or?
I guess, yeah.
Well, I guess at least one
that
song
one
on
my
Radio
Christmas song.
Oh, well, your Christmas song is amazing. I do love that song. It's funny because I have requested that song before and you're just like, what? It's not Christmas. But then if Gina requests it, it's like, oh, well, we have to play it if Gina requests it. Like, what? So, but at least like, I know that Gina will request it and then you'll play it. Sometimes if I request it, you're like, no, it's not Christmas. I'm not playing that song.
Well, you know, having somebody else request it, gave it credibility instead of just you. And usually your request list is quite long. So I can pick and choose from that.
Listen, I have a lot of songs that I like, and some of them are older. Some of them are a little deep cut. Like, it's not just always, you know, the hits. I like to mix it up a little bit. I think everybody has their favorite songs. But for some reason, Gina and I both really like Coconut for Christmas.
Well, I think you like that song. I think she's messing with me.
Oh. Well, that doesn't make me feel as good.
That's like, that's like going to a Bad Monkey show and requesting Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer. Randy recorded that song, what was that, 35 years ago? And he's got to play that song at every show for the rest of his life. That's his Margaritaville, man. That's like his Light My Fire. He's got to play. I was at a show one time in Lake Charles, Louisiana in July, and Randy Brooks was up there singing Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer. I was like, you know what? If that guy can play that song in July, I can play Coconut for Christmas. Get over yourself, Carwin.
Yeah. Also, like, it's only your own fault for writing a super catchy song that's really fun to sing along with. So
that's right.
You can't be mad at people for being like, I really want to hear a song that you wrote.
You're a jerk. How dare you request that song?
So do you have on your new album, do you have a favorite song? Is that, I don't know if it's too hard to play favorites, but like, is there one that kind of stands out for you as like, if someone was going to request a song from your new album, would you have a preference of your favorite one to play?
I actually, my favorite song on the record is one that I think would be pretty difficult to do live just because of the production element. Like the acoustic version of it is pretty short, but when you flesh it all out, it came out to a full size song. It's got all the parts to it. It's called I Know You. And it's really unique in the record. But it jumps out to me every time I hear it. I'm like, yeah, this is, I really like listening to it. In fact, today I'm going to shoot a music video for it.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I think that song, and I don't mean this as an insult. Hopefully you will not take it as
thanks.
It. But I could really picture, like, I feel like it's really modern. Like, I could really picture, like, a young pop star singing that song for some reason. Yep. And I don't mean that to say that, like, it's not unique or something, or, like, it's, like, every other song on the radio. But I just feel like it has, like, a really young, like, modern vibe to it. When I was listening to it, I was like, oh, I could totally picture, like, hearing this on, like, regular pop radio.
Yeah, I agree with you. And because I'm older and my voice sounds older than a pop star, that's what makes it country. You know, it's pop music by old white guys is country music. So it sounds different, but I think in the context of the record, it fits in with all the other songs, but it's unique in the production style of it. So it does kind of jump out. It sets apart, but I just really like the way that came out and just the groove of it, but just solo acoustic. It's when I play it solo acoustic, it really starts to sound like, Steal My Kisses by Ben Harper. Steal my kisses from you.
Yeah.
You know, that's how it kind of comes across solo acoustic, but with the production and everything, it really elevated it. So I think that's right now, that's my favorite song on the record.
Cool. Yeah. One of my other favorites is I Drink. I like that one a lot. So you might be getting some requests for that song.
I wrote that one specifically for the Fools on Stools show last year. I wasn't going to be there and I wanted to pre-record something that they could play at the show. And we did a bit where it was in Key West and it was Donnie Brewer and Matt Hogg. I forget who was up on the stage, but they broadcast. They had this screen behind them the whole time that was just a picture of an empty living room. And everybody thought it was just a backdrop, like a comfy home backdrop, but it was really my living room that they were broadcasting there. And at one point I walk into the screen, I had pre-recorded this whole thing, but I did it. We set it up like Donnie had set up a spy camera in my living room. And so I came out and I was sitting on a stool playing this song. And it was, and I left a space in it. So Donnie live at the show was playing the guitar solo to my recording. It was hilarious, but I wrote that song specifically for that show. And we ended up like finishing it and putting it on the record. So it's, yeah. And it's also a really good t-shirt. I Drink to Make You More Interesting.
Yeah. It's always a plus when you can put something on a t-shirt and people want
that's right.
Well, speaking of Key West, since you brought that up, we can talk a little bit about your campaign for TRMA.
Entertainer of the Year.
Thank you. I was like, what order is the words? Yes. Entertainer of the Year for 2020.
That's right.
Do you have, like, now that Meeting of the Minds is canceled, like, do you still have the same, are you going to do anything differently? Do you still have the same campaign plans as previously?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The campaign plans are to have absolutely no plan whatsoever and just keep saying it over and over again and people just accept it. I just want people to just go, fine, you can be Entertainer of the Year this year if you'll just shut up. Then I know I've done my job.
Just beat it into them emotionally. Like if they hear it enough times, they'll just cave and be like, all right, well, I guess we have to vote for Bob Carwin because he's said it the most and the loudest.
That's exactly my plan.
Are you also using that same campaign plan for your city council campaign? Because that is a real campaign that you are doing right now.
Yeah, that's very strange to be running for Trop Rock Music Association Entertainer of the Year and City of Menifee City Council at the same time. It's very odd juxtaposition, but yeah, it's a different tone for the city council.
Are you worried that
same t-shirts running, though?
Yeah. Yes. And there are great shirts. I own one. I was going to wear it, but nobody could see me. So I did not really, it doesn't like this. Is
so
a
you
podcast,
went without a shirt entirely.
Yes. Yes. Just for the listeners. And it's a good shirt and you can buy that shirt on your city council Bob Carwin for City Council website. Is that right? That's
right. Carwinforcouncil.com.
It's a good shirt. You should buy that shirt. Are you concerned that in your campaign for City Council that any late night Bob Carwin sing-along parties will come out and stain your reputation?
Yes. which is why I've always been pretty diligent about trying
don't record
to
that.
Yeah. For a couple of reasons. One, you know, when people are recording, they tend not to be in the moment. They're thinking about the recording and their phone and all that other stuff. And doing the late night shows, people really need to be present for that. If they're distracted or not involved, it's just not fun. And then the other people who record it, if they go back and listen to it, they're going to want it to be like that or what. It's just, it happens so organically. You know, there were times where people were like, when we do those shows, people used to try to schedule them like, okay, tonight at 10 o'clock will be the late night show, go. And it never works. It's always just a matter of we're all just sitting around and somebody pulls out the guitar and we start playing. And so it's got to be an organic thing. And then people try to ruin it by taking pictures and recording and all that other stuff. And and for the people who are kind of around or in the room, they tend to be, I don't know, tighter and not having as much fun when they know they're being recorded and captured and things like that. So, you know, for all those reasons. And then besides the fact is like, you know what, I'd like to be kind of a myth out there. People don't really know what's happening. So I'm sure there are recordings of it, but very few.
Yeah. I would also argue that for the people in the room, there is a feeling of like, oh, this is, you know, just our little special like thing that like, cause it's not like a thing you do at every show, like you said. So, it's kind of like, oh, well, if we record this and put it out there, then it's like everybody has seen this and we're not part of this like secret society, late night Bob Carwin club, you know? So
I'll tell you, it's really fun for me when I do an event where I'm there for the full weekend and we do, you know, a late night party show like that on Friday night and then all day Saturday, but it's going, when are you going to do the show tonight? When are you going to do the show tonight? I'm like, oh, it was last night, man. Why did you do it? I wasn't there. It's like, oh, that's too bad. You should have hung out, man.
Yeah.
And so
you shouldn't have gotten drunk at like 3 p.m. and gone to bed.
So for the people who were there, it feels like, yeah, we made it. Yeah. And, you know, it's not like it's that much of a golden goose or whatever, but it's just a matter of it, since you don't know when it's going to happen or if it's going to happen or anything like that, scheduling, make sure you're in room 603 tonight at 9:30. It's just ridiculous. So, but if it organically happens, usually it's part of something that people tend to remember for the whole weekend.
I do love the traditional Bob Carwin late night party as much as the next person. It's really fun to, you know, yell out the things you get to yell out. But I think one of my favorites was the Jimmy Buffett covers late night party that was like you and I think Mike Nash and Mark, was it?
Yeah, Mark Mulligan was
there.
Three
of you guys, which is an unusual happenstance in itself that like Mark Mulligan was there that late because usually he's not out later. So it was a combination of like Mark Mulligan hanging out late, which he doesn't really ever do. I think that was like one of the first times like Mike Nash was at a thing that I was at. And it was like, oh, like there's a lot of Jimmy Buffett happening right now. And like as a person who loves trop rock and I love all the original songs, I still am like a big Jimmy Buffett fan. So like getting to hear a bunch of guys that like I don't usually get to hear play Jimmy Buffett covers just like do a bunch of like really deep cut Jimmy Buffett was so magical.
There was a lot of fun that, well, the year before that, as I recall, they had tried to do a Stump the Band Jimmy Buffett thing as an actual event, which was a disaster.
Yeah, that didn't go well.
Well, because the only person who knew all the songs was Sonny Jim, and he had to cancel, so it was a huge disaster. So, you know, doing it organic—that's exactly what I'm talking about. If you try to schedule something like that, it comes across as stiff and not very fun. But when it organically just kind of happens, and then nobody's expecting anything, then, you know, if you screw up or whatever, it doesn't make any difference because you're not scheduled to be on stage, and you look unprofessional if it's 3 o'clock in the morning and you mess up one of the lyrics to Delaney Looks at Statues, nobody's going to, you know, want their money back.
Yeah, no, probably not. Most people probably wouldn't even notice that you had screwed up lyrics.
That's right.
But yeah, so I think that I'm in full support of the no recording late night shows. But I don't know if anybody listening to this podcast lives in Menifee. They probably not. But like, do you want to talk at all about like your platform or like your city council running, or is that for a different podcast?
Yeah, the Blame It on Buffett podcast is not really to break down the public safety issues of Menifee, California, and we're going to discuss the pros and cons of repealing Measure DD. I don't think this is a place where anybody cares about that even a little bit.
But they do care about the shirts. And the great thing about the shirts is that it just says Bob 2020. So you can wear it, you can buy it in support of the city council campaign, or you can buy it and wear it in support of the Entertainer of the Year campaign. Like, it's really covers all your bases.
Or for somebody else entirely named Bob. It doesn't even have to be me. The name Carwin isn't even on it.
That's true. I've been rewatching Twin Peaks lately, and the name Bob associated with that show is like not pleasant. So I'm trying to focus on when I wear that shirt, I'm trying to focus on Bob Carwin, not Bob from Twin Peaks.
Good point.
I do want to before we go, I know it's getting a little past the hour here as per usual. I could just talk forever, but I wanted to do like a little get to know you question. I'm sure like probably everyone listening to this podcast already knows you, but like maybe something that is a little bit different than maybe questions you've been asked before. And I want to know if you had to pick a few bands. I know I'm springing this on you right now, so maybe like 3 to 5 or however, like 1 or 2, if that's all you can think of, that you would put on the soundtrack for your own life, who would they be? And not like, so bear in mind, not like your favorite musicians or bands, but like the ones that you think would be best to accompany your life if we were watching you, like on a TV show or a movie.
Wow, that is a unique question. But I'd say pretty much everything I do is I always have.
Or would it just be your own music on your own soundtrack?
Well, that's a different station. So I would say there's usually a Jay Giles Band song running through my head at any given moment throughout the day. And so I've just, you know, because I grew up in Boston, so my whole, most of everything I do is based on some part of, on a Jay Giles song. So going back in their catalog before even like Love Stinks, back into the back catalog all the way through the end. So yeah, it would have to be that. Stevie Ray Vaughan, probably Zac Brown, Todd Snyder, absolutely. But not so much his music, but just the intros to his songs, just the spoken parts. Or if you listen to a Todd Snyder concert, it'll have like intro 18 minutes. And then the song is like 3 minutes and 20 seconds.
So it would just be like a narration of like if you were on a TV show where there was a narrator that was just narrating what you were doing.
Yeah, I'd say that's probably a good call. and then probably specifically the song "Since You've Been Gone" by Rainbow, little heavy metal hard rock stuff. Not so much the whole catalog of the band, but that particular song. So I'd say that's 4 right there.
All right, I think that's a good assortment, and that's something I think I don't know why I was like trying to go to sleep last night, and this question just came into my head. But I think it's really interesting because the bands that would be best to accompany people's lives and like what they do are not necessarily the same as like their, like, you know, like every person's like, okay, well, what's your favorite bands or whatever. But like, I feel like this is like a right? There might be some crossover with favorite bands, but like, it's like, okay, well, I really like this band, but like I really like, you know, Dashboard Confessional, like since high school, but like, also, since high school, those songs don't really apply to my life in any way. So, because I'm not like
those songs come back around though. Those songs come back around.
So great, and actually, he just did a reunion tour this past year, and we went, and it was amazing. It was like just like being back at a high school show, except that like everybody there was like 35.
Yeah, that happened to me. I went to a Ben Folds 5 show, and I was the oldest guy there by about 15 years. It was really a weird experience.
Ben Folds is great. Do love me some Ben Folds.
You ever watch his Tiny Desk concert on NPR?
No, I don't think so.
You know that series? Do you know the Tiny Desk concert series?
I think I've heard of it. I don't know if I've actually seen any of them though.
So if you go on YouTube and just search Tiny Desk Concerts, they put them all up on YouTube. And the concept is that the band comes in and they play in the offices of All Music Considered at NPR. And so they're cramped in against this desk and stuff. The my two favorite ones that I go back and watch all the time are Ben Folds and Lizzo. Lizzo is phenomenal. They do three songs and it's just like acoustically right there against the desk. And I highly recommend that after we're done today, you go and watch Lizzo's Tiny Desk Concert from NPR. It is insanely good.
Okay. I will make a note of that. And good tip for the listeners too. Okay. Well, thank you so much for being here. And before we go, do you want to talk about, do you have upcoming events, other things you want to plug?
Yeah. So, well, I'm really excited because all the shows have been canceled for months and months and months. So the first one that's really going to happen, I'm going to be at it, is called Trop Rock in the Ozarks. And it's an event at the Margaritaville Resort in Lake Ozark, Missouri. I just finished watching Ozark, so I'm a little bit nervous, but I don't think that applies to the Margaritaville Resort somehow.
Probably not.
But I'm really excited. It's a huge event. It's going for the whole weekend, and I'm doing a Pirates and Poets show on Friday and then a main stage event for a main stage show for the event. So that's really coming up. And then booking probably going to start to happen, not until next year for other kind of shows, but we'll see what starts opening up. But I really want people to go and get the record. My new album, The Miles Between, is available for digital purchase right now on my website, bobcarwin.com. You can get it there. And then we've just ordered the digital distribution, the iTunes and all that stuff, and then the hard copy CDs. So that'll all be up in the next 2 weeks to 30 days. But right now, as you listen to this, if you want to get it right now, you can go to bobcarwin.com, the merchandise and music page, and get it there.
Yes. Thank you for mentioning the title of the album, because I don't think I had done that. I'm really killing it at this whole podcast hosting situation. And if people want to find you, follow you on social media, do you want to?
Oh, yeah. Well, just basically you put my name in the internet and it pops up in a variety of places. So I'm all over the place. I've got like five different Facebook profiles. It confuses people very much.
It is very confusing.
But so I'm on Twitter at Bob Carwin. I'm on Instagram at Bob Carwin. I'm on, you know, my website is, and it's with a K. It's BobKarwin, as in Nancy, bobcarwin.com. And from there, that if you go to the website, it links to all the social media outlets. So you can go to all of those places.
Cool.
I'm very hilarious on Twitter.
That's always great when somebody thinks that they're hilarious on Twitter. It's usually
that's how you know they're hilarious, when somebody says that they're hilarious. I'm quite the humorist.
And I mentioned this before while you were doing dog stuff, but if you follow Bob Carwin on Instagram, there's some really cute puppy photos. So that's my
recommendation. Right. We'll put some more up there. In between my breakfast photos, I'll put up puppy photos too.
Yeah, I'm always like, Bob Carwin, more dog photos. And then you just don't listen to me, but that's fine. maybe now that it's been public on a podcast, we'll have people demanding dog photos.
Oh, we'll have literally tens of people demanding it.
That's right. Listen, my listeners come in baker's dozens. So there's like 13 of them.
That's impressive. You know, one time I was on the Big Burrito radio show. I was down in New Orleans for Mardi Gras, and I was being interviewed up on the balcony of the Tropical Isle by Marty on his Big Burrito radio show. And I was commenting to him there that it was interesting that we probably had a bigger audience of people listening from the street below than on the entire radio airwaves.
Yeah. Well, I don't have like a million listeners or anything, but actually like more people have been listening than I really expected. So it's actually been kind of nice. Like, it's not just like, oh, two people listen to the podcast.
That's right.
And so I appreciate that people are taking the time, but I really think it's because of the guests, you know, like you say, like, oh, you have Bob Carwin on your show. Like, people are going to listen to that. If it was just me talking, I'm sure I would have 0 to 1 listeners. So,
well, I've had shows where I probably could have just opened the window and yelled out and reached more people than I did on the radio. But this one is, I like your show. I like the podcast. I think it's good. You've got that podcast voice. So yeah, I like it.
Thanks. Thanks for being here. And I would be happy to have you back. I'm sure we could talk about a lot more other things in the future. What the other nice surprises is like I'm getting many more volunteers and suggestions for guests than I expected. Like I was expecting to have to really fight for people to come on the show. So I'm like, oh yeah, you could come back. But maybe in the future, after I have a few other people,
I don't really just have to have by, my friends. You're surprised on by every how much episode. musicians want to talk about themselves. They'll come on.
I guess I shouldn't have been that surprised. Okay. Well, thank you so much for being on. I really appreciate it. It was great talking to you. And I will hopefully see you soon. I don't really know when that will be, but somewhere down the line.
We will see you very, very soon. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks. Okay. So, like I said, that was a fun interview. It's always good to talk to Carwin, about, all the shenanigans that he gets up to. I'm glad he clarified that story about, the covers thing, because I definitely had it in my mind that like Bob Carwin didn't like covers, except, you know, the ones that he usually plays. But I really love the cover on that he does on this new album. So, I'm glad he put that on there. And I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, if you want to contact me, you can find me at, blameitonbuffettpodcast@gmail.com. You can send me anything you want to there. I mean, like not anything, let's keep it appropriate, but you know, if you have comments about the podcast, suggestions, I will say, like I said, during the interview, I have had a lot of guest volunteers and also suggestions from people. So, I'm happy to hear more suggestions. You can keep sending me those, or if you would like to, if you're a musician or a fan or whoever, and you want to be on, you can let me know. But I do have kind of a backlog of people to interview at this point. So it might be a little bit down the road before we get to that, but still, like if you think of someone, if you don't want to forget, send it to me. I'd love to hear your feedback. So you can also find me at Blame Buffett Pod on Twitter and Instagram, and Blame It on Buffett Podcast on Facebook. I've found that people in this community tend to seem to interact the most on Facebook, but I personally probably spend the most time on Instagram. And so, yeah, if you're into Instagram and Twitter, you can totally find me there too. And you can message me there if you don't want to email me. You can also leave me a voice message on the Anchor, website for my podcast, which is the link is in, all of my social media posts and everything. I haven't actually had anyone do that yet, but I'm still holding out hope that someday I might get a voice message. I think it would be fun to, if we could get it rolling as an actual thing where people submit me questions or whatever, and then I can answer them on the podcast because I can just edit in that audio that you send me. So that would be fun. You can leave me a message there. Somebody did leave me a review on Apple Podcasts with like an actual written review, not just like the star rating. So I really appreciate that, whoever that was. It doesn't really say your name, so I can't tell, but I really appreciate that you did that. Basically, just the way to get this podcast out there is like review it, share it with your friends. It seems like we've definitely had a bump in listenership since Eric and Gina kind of shared with everybody. So I really appreciate that. But yeah, so I, and like I said, like already way more people are listening to this than I really expected when I started this project. So I really appreciate all of you, the listeners. I've met some really cool, nice people, because of this podcast, not just musicians, but, people that are writing to me, suggesting things or, you know, saying like, hey, like, here's my music or whatever. So yeah, it's been a really great time. And, I'm really excited to be like meeting some new people in the Parrothead trap rock community, so that down the line when we do actually all go to events again, and I can see those people in person, it'll be a fun like, oh hey, you know, like we met on Facebook message or we were on the podcast but we've never met in person. It's kind of a fun way for me to meet new people and get out of my shell. So like I said, thank you for listening. I hope that you enjoyed that interview with Bob Carwin. And we are going to now play Alan the Taxi Man. And until next time, remember to vote Bob 2020.
If it's your first time on the island, you gotta get yourself a guide. Someone who knows the ropes, who's connected on the inside. You don't want to drive yourself, cause surely you'll be lost. They love to ticket the tourists, cause they know you'll pay the cost. You gotta call Alan the Taxi Man, circling the island in his big white van. He knows rough town like the back of his hand. He's Alan the Taxi Man, yeah. Hotel where the president once stayed. He'll take you to a nightclub where the Latin dogs once played. And if you're craving roti, he knows just the place. He'll show you where the locals go with a smile on his face. You gotta call Alan the Taxi Man, circling the island in his big white van. He knows roti town at the back of his hand. He's Alan the Taxi Man, yeah. $20, he won't turn it down.